Mueller investigation is trying to determine if Cambridge knowingly provided the RFIRA or Trump team with that extra bit of data targeting the 77,000 voters of Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin that gave Trump his victory. The data flow was so precise, there is no way Russia could know which specific voters in those states would be open to their propaganda. Only Americans on the ground could know with that level of specificity. If Cambridge or its staff passed the specific individual voter data collected for the Trump team on to Moscow so that the RFIRA could target its messages to a specific block of voters, they may be exposed to much, much more than embarrassment, as both England and the United States laws would consider working for the Kremlin an act of espionage. The Internet Research Agency and other troll farms weren't the only Russian intelligence subcontractors in the 2016 election. Media investigations found that there were young, English-speaking men in Macedonia generating non-stop pro-Trump fake news stories for purely economic reasons. They would then feed these stories to Facebook pages and collect revenue via Google AdSense. They also created pro-Trump websites with domain names like DonaldTrumpNews.com, WorldPoliticus.com, and USA Daily Politics, which were then filled with fake news from numerous sources in the Russian information sphere. In a town with very little economic potential for young men, $5,000 per month is a lot of money. They did not have to maintain a news staff, as their content was appropriated from other fake news sites from the United States. They found that posting pro-Trump materials were the most profitable, but had no vested interest in his success during the election of 2016. However, they profited Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin to no end. The motivation for creating fake news ranges from an intentional desire to mislead people for political reasons to a raw desire for money from the ad revenue generated by ad clicks. In web speak, clickbait refers to content that is manufactured purely to get viewers to click the Read More link. The content may be partially true and misleading, or completely made up. Ad-based revenue can generate thousands of dollars for site owners who create or aggregate fake or misleading partisan news. Using ad services like Google AdSense, for instance, content creators can monetize these manufactured stories. Then, to drive traffic to these sites, creators can purchase ads on Facebook to draw viewers of all political leanings to the content. Fake news ads can generate lots of views on Facebook. For $33, a single ad can reach up to 60,000 Facebook users per day. Approximately 12% of the tweets posted from these accounts also attempted to mask the origin of the account by using VPN, Virtual Private Network Access. VPN allows users to access content indirectly to appear to be coming in from another location. For example, a death threat against the author used a VPN to access American servers. Once on the internet, it appeared to be in Denver, Colorado. VPN isn't a guaranteed method to disguise the user's origin, as counter-hackers discovered the death threats actually originated at the RFIRA in St. Petersburg, Russia. In terms of social media, a bot refers to the use of software that posts, reposts, and interacts like sentient human users. It's a takeoff from robot, but since they tend to act autonomously, the ro for remote was removed from the term. In propaganda warfare, bots are automated software weapons designed to disperse propaganda. They are the particles in a mist of influence warfare. Bots are the vehicles of manipulating perceptions. They are the cockroaches of computational propaganda. By using bot deployment technology to influence target audiences, they became the force multiplier for modern active measures. Had Stalin or Hitler had bot dispersal systems, they would currently be ruling the world. RFIRA gets indicted. On February 16, 2018, Special Counsel Robert Mueller filed an indictment at the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia titled The United States versus the Internet Research Agency, RFIRA, Concord Management and Consulting, LLC, and Concord Catering. The indictment alleged that the research organization was, in fact, a Russian organization engaged in operations to interfere with elections in political processes. According to the indictment, beginning in late 2013, the organization was formed, hired staff, and planned and received orders to manipulate the U.S. presidential election through the largest Russian intelligence active measure ever conducted against the United States, a broad-based information warfare campaign to change the minds of American citizens. The RFIRA conducted their operations by setting up tens of thousands of social media websites, Facebook groups and pages, and Twitter feeds designed to look like American citizens posting information to attract conservative American audiences. Additionally, they used marionetting, where they manipulated real people by pretending to be U.S. citizens and organized protests with civic groups who were convinced that they were communicating with legitimate people, not Russian agents. Surprisingly, the Mueller indictment wasn't the first to identify the activities in these troll factories. One former employee of the RFIRA named Lyudmila Savchuk attempted to expose the troll factory despite the risk of retaliation. She and others claim that the Russian government protects the organization. She sued the RFIRA over worker conditions and pay. Working with a lawyer named Ivan Pavlov from an NGO called Team 29, they represented Savchuk and another employee, Olga Maltseva, in her case against the RFIRA. The heat from the Mueller investigation and the FBI on RFIRA for the activities during the American, French, and German elections proved too much. By 2017, they had been forced to shut down, change their name to Teka, and move to a new location on Belostrovskaya Street in St. Petersburg. Then they resumed operations once Trump was in office. They attacked Robert Mueller, the FBI, and any critic of Donald Trump or Vladimir Putin. The Internet Research Agency and other troll farms weren't the only Russian intelligence subcontractors in the 2016 election. Media investigations found that there were young, English-speaking men in Macedonia generating non-stop pro-Trump fake news stories for purely economic reasons. It's likely they may not have known they were subcontracted by the RFIRA, as the products were virtually identical to Russia bots. The Macedonian bot farm also fed stories to Facebook pages and collected revenue via Google AdSense. They also created pro-Trump websites with domain names like DonaldTrumpNews.co, WorldPoliticus.com, and USA Daily Politics, which were then filled with fake news from numerous sources in the Russian information sphere. In a town with very little economic potential for young men, $5,000 per month is a lot of money. They did not have to maintain a news staff, as their content was appropriated from other fake news sites around the United States. They found that posting pro-Trump materials were the most profitable, but had no vested interest in his success during the election of 2016. However, they profited Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin to no end. The motivation for creating fake news ranges from a desire to mislead people for political reasons to a need to gain money from the ad revenue generated by ad clicks. In web speak, clickbait refers to content that is manufactured purely to get viewers to click the Read More link. The content may be partially true and misleading, or completely made up. Ad-based revenue can generate thousands of dollars for site owners who create or aggregate misleading partisan news. Using ad services like Google AdSense, for instance, content creators can monetize these manufactured stories. Then, to drive traffic to these sites, creators can purchase ads on Facebook to draw viewers of all political leanings to the content. Fake news ads can generate lots of views on Facebook. For $33, a single ad can reach up to 60,000 Facebook users per day. So how did the RFIRA manage to fool Americans into thinking they were chatting with other real but fake Americans? They masked their true location. Approximately 12% of the tweets posted from RFIRA accounts attempted to mask the origin by using a VPN, Virtual Private Network Access. VPN allows users to access content indirectly, and if done correctly, it appears to originate from another location. For example, death threats against myself used a VPN to access American servers and appeared to originate on a Twitter account in Denver, Colorado. VPN isn't a guaranteed method to disguise the user's origin, as counter-hackers discovered my death threats actually originated at the RFIRA in St. Petersburg, Russia. Propaganda products, fake news articles, and crazy Russian death threats are not mass-broadcasted tens of thousands of times a day by a real human being. The human element drafts the product, but uses a self-replicating, self-transmitting piece of computer software called a bot. A bot refers to the use of software that posts, reposts, and interacts like sentient human users. It's a takeoff from the word robot. In propaganda warfare, bots are automated software weapons designed to disperse propaganda and fill blank spaces with their own message, like the particles in a mist of influence warfare. They are the cockroaches of computational propaganda, as they can invade any crevice, no matter how seemingly secure, and cannot appear to be eliminated entirely. By using bot-deploying technology to influence target audiences, the RFIRA became a globally unique information force in modern active measures. Had Stalin or Hitler had bot dispersal systems, they would currently be ruling the world. Creating accounts that appear to share topical or partisan affinity, mixed with hashtag promotion, allowed bots to drive public opinion. People tend to enjoy spreading messages they agree with, no matter how obscure the source or crazy the claim. Human curiosity and gullibility are the dispersal agents of the bot. Russia became aware of this and turned it into an idea-changing weapon. Russians did not just attempt to rig elections in the United States, France, and Germany, but also influence operations like the policy debates of Brexit, immigration, or the Russia probe in the United States. The first place they experimented was on the Russian people. Recall that Yevgeny Prigozhin himself created the Kharkiv news agency and used bots to flood fake news and horrible comments using fake individuals to push the Kremlin's view. Another tool in the Russian arsenal was the use of fake news fire hydrants called botnets. A botnet is comprised of a string of connected computers and devices that run automated software, bots, for a particular task. When used by a nation-state, it can act as a virtual army that transcends the attacker's point of origin. Imagine every fire hydrant in a city exploding and flooding the streets. The botnet would be the water main system feeding those hydrants. Botnets might be used to conduct distributed denial of service, DDoS attacks, where your internet access is clogged by flooding data. Brute force login attacks, where massive computer power tries billions of attempts to log into server or website administration logins, or to spread malware, ad clicking fraud, and email spam. Botnets were first deployed in the early 2000s and continued to expand in complexity and capabilities over the years. Every bot had a job, and in many ways they mimic roles previously carried out by human beings in the espionage world. Those people were named agents of influence, agents provocateurs, and chaos agents. Today, bots fill these roles. Bots operate in botnets, chats, which could include millions of messages of every type that are usually focused on one propaganda objective. In the weeks leading up to the 2016 election, Russian-linked bots retweeted 47,846 at Hillary Clinton tweets, while tweets from at Real Donald Trump were retweeted 469,537 times. Similarly, at Hillary Clinton tweets received 119,730 likes from Russian-linked bots, compared to 517,408 likes of at Real Donald Trump tweets by Russian-linked bots. Twitter also examined content being shared from known and alleged Russian cutouts, including from WikiLeaks, Guccifer 2.0, and DC Leaks. They noted at WikiLeaks posts were retweeted 196,836 times, at Guccifer underscore 2 tweets were retweeted 24,000 times, and at DC Leaks underscore tweets were retweeted 6,774 times by Russian-linked bots. A unique bot seen in the 2016 election could be called the agitation bot. In human terms, it would be an agent provocateur, where it would pose as a local resident and exhort followers to show up at a protest or real-life street action. Of course, a bot can be used to organize the place and time of an event such as a protest. We use them all the time on our mobile phone schedulers. The trick is to make real people think it is a real person scheduling the event. Once people show up in real life, even without a bot organizer, they generally will spontaneously continue the protest activity. The Internet Research Agency created 129 Facebook events between 2015 and 2017. Facebook reported to the Senate Intelligence Committee that the posted events were viewed by over 300,000 users and that around 62,500 planned to attend the events and 25,800 were interested in attending the event. All these Americans were being manipulated like marionettes by puppeteers in St. Petersburg, Russia. For example, Russian accounts used Facebook to promote pro-Trump rallies like the Florida Goes Trump rally on August 20, 2016. The rally was promoted on the Facebook page created by username March for Trump. The page called Being Patriotic promoted this event along with a Down with Hillary event in New York at the Hillary Clinton campaign headquarters. Another example. The trolls posted opposing events for May 21, 2016 in Houston, Texas, around the opening of an Islamic Center library. Both sides, including Stop Islamization of Texas protesters and Save Islamic Knowledge, were actually Russian entities trying to create mayhem. Some comments related to the event issued threats of violence aimed at Muslim Americans. In January 2017, a more unusual case of Russian intelligence marionetting of an unwitting innocent citizen using a hybrid mix of bots, human, and web propaganda involved a martial arts teacher named Omawale Adewale. He was asked if he wanted to facilitate training self-defense classes to African Americans. Under the banner of Black Fist Self-Defense Project, he conducted over a dozen trainings between January and May 2017 and was paid $320 via PayPal and Google Wallet for the sessions. However, Adewale never met the people who were soliciting him to conduct the classes. Instead, the events were part of a campaign developed by Russian intelligence and the Internet Research Agency. Adewale was first contacted by a person who identified himself as Taylor. Taylor asked him to collect information on the participants. In other examples, the name Jacob Johnson has been used. The group used a website, blackfist.pro, to promote the trainings and even arranged interviews with podcasts like No Holds Barred, with a host named Eddie Goldman. The podcast discussions with Adewale were conducted by phone. Text of the interview was posted to the blog SureDog.com. We all understand that since the election of Donald Trump, there have been a lot of, I'll say, hate crimes against minorities. And so we thought that it's a good idea where, as black people, we could be able to defend ourselves. The main idea is not even the defense. It's just being able to be in a position to defend ourselves. And also, we understand that self-defense is something that, if you know, it boosts your own self-esteem. To accomplish this, this year they have begun holding a series of seminars and self-defense classes around the U.S. At this time, these classes have been held in New York and Florida, with more locations soon to be announced. The trainers include Omawale Adewale, a kickboxer, boxer, and MMA fighter based in New York. In addition, we open with a commentary on the importance of using the combat sports to fight the rise of reaction we see today, and of following the time-tested slogan on "an injury to one is an injury to all." This was an active measure to create the impression that African Americans were preparing to focus their aggression through mixed martial arts-type street fighting. Had this succeeded, the propaganda would have been spread across RT, Sputnik, and Fox News to terrify white Americans who support Donald Trump. When it comes to using bots, hashtags are relatively easy to program since they can be adopted, updated, and repeated. This made hashtags, symbolized by the pound sign, a perfect companion to information warfare campaigns which were aimed to draw attention to themselves. The Internet Research Agency drove several propaganda campaigns in Europe well before the U.S. election. They used hashtags, hashtag Frexit, French, exit the EU, hashtag Grexit, Greek, exit the EU, hashtag Brexit vote, hashtag pray for London, hashtag ban Islam, and hashtag Brexit. In the United States, they drove hashtags, hashtag Cal exit, Northern California separatists, hashtag Texit, Texas Republican separatists, hashtag white genocide, and hashtag Black Lives Matter. In the 1960s, Service A, the disinformation service of the KGB, sought to sow racial division around Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. King was the target of active measures organized under KGB officer Yuri Modin. The KGB campaign to inflame racial tensions included sending fake pamphlets to black activist organizations meant to instigate tension with the Jewish Defense League. But decades later, it would be RFIRA-driven trolls seeking to exacerbate tensions around the Black Lives Matter campaign. This time, it would be a competing set of Twitter accounts joining the fight to instigate division between hashtag Black Lives Matter, hashtag Blue Lives Matter, and hashtag All Lives Matter hashtags. A University of Washington examination of the accounts associated with the Internet Research Agency found that 29 of them were feeding the hashtag war on all sides. In the lead-up to the 2016 election, the hashtag DNC leak was used. In the 2 months before the election, 26,500 users created 154,800 tweets with the hashtag DNC leak. This included 3% that were Russian-linked accounts. Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta's emails had been stolen after a successful spear phishing attack by Cozy Bear. He was tricked when he clicked on a link that pretended to be a Google security alert. In the weeks before the election, WikiLeaks published 118 tweets with the hashtag Podesta emails. Twitter said nearly 5% of the tweets with this hashtag were generated from Russia-linked accounts for a return of 20% of the impressions for the first week of posting. Twitter estimated 64,000 users created 484,000 tweets with variations of this hashtag in the 2 months before the election. Twitter later testified that it sought to reduce the exposure of these hashtags and limited their distribution. It drew an immediate outcry from not only right-wing and conspiracy theory sites in America, but also from Russia Today and the Sputnik website. Both groups called this censoring. In early January 2018, there was an effort by Chairman of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, Representative Devin Nunes, and other Republicans to discredit the investigation into Trump's relationship with Russia. A memo drafted by Nunes accused the FBI of abusing the FISA, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, process to target Donald Trump and his campaign staff. Soon after rumors of this report surfaced, the Russian-originated hashtag #ReleaseTheMemo appeared on January 18, 2018. It was quickly shared over 3,000 times in a two-day period following the announcement of the memo's existence. Other deep state hashtags were launched to accompany this effort, including #FISAGate, #ObamaDeepState, #WeThePeopleDemandJustice, #TheMemoReveals TheCoup, and #ObamasLegacyIsObamaGate. In addition, #SchumerShutdown was launched in a failed attempt to rival another #TrumpShutdown after the administration allowed the government to shut down for 2 days. On many accounts, it was added to posts with #ReleaseTheMemo. So pervasive was the belief that Russia was pushing the hashtags, many real conservatives started posting #IAmNotARussianBot. It was amusing until RFIRA posts used it as well. In early 2018, Twitter updated its methods of detecting bots and Russian-associated accounts after the election in response to demands to deal with the abuse of their platform. This included examining what qualifies as Russian-linked or RFIRA-linked. Criteria for this included determining where the account user was located, use of Russian email addresses, if the account was created from a Russian IP address, or if the account had been accessed from a Russian IP address. In some cases, use of Cyrillic in usernames or display names was considered, or if Cyrillic was used in the sign-up interface. Hoaxes. 48 hours in the life of an assassination bot. Bots may be automated software spreading propaganda everywhere, but they can also be retasked by their human handlers to intervene and focus a hateful message against very specific people and try to bring about violence at the hands of their puppets. In late July 2017, Moscow decided that they had enough of my and Joy Ann Reed's free use of television. In late July 2017, I was attending Politicon, the convention for politics in Pasadena, California. 2 days before the scheduled panel on From Russia with Trump, an account on Twitter began to issue death threats against both Joy Reid and me. The person promised an armed confrontation at the convention, but upon very close inspection, it was determined this was a Russian bot, programmed to pretend to act like an American citizen. The account was named Mario_Savio. It was found on Twitter encouraging people to confront me and others at the Pasadena Convention Center. When it was investigated, it appeared to be a legitimate account, but on closer inspection it was found that the Russian bot had typo-squatted and mimicked a real account right down to stealing the profile and photo. Typo-squatting is when an online name appears almost identical to another, but distinguished by a hard-to-see typographic error. In this instance, the Russian programmer added an additional underscore mark to the legitimate account Mario_Savio. A review of the bot's history found that it had been operating as an agent of influence bot using a series of attacks and attempts to pump up followers. For almost 90 days, it posted negative comments on Twitter about four TV personalities, Bill Maher, Joy Ann Reid, Rachel Maddow, and Michael Moore. A shift came when it started to attack Republican Senator John McCain, who had criticized Donald Trump for his response to Russian aggression. In response to McCain, The account repeatedly attempted to associate the senator with conspiracy theories about his funding ISIS and the war in Syria. Further back, the account focused on Ukraine, Syria, and other topics that are typical of Russian geopolitical discussion. 48 hours before the Politicon conference, the bot was retasked to agent provocateur mode. It started notifying a Southern California pro-Trump forum of my presence at Politicon and requested followers to come there. 24 hours before the panel, it was retasked again and went into chaos agent mode. The bot started issuing death threats against Joy Reid and myself. It started posting threatening posters of me with a sniper's crosshair on it with the text, Wanted, for inciting hashtag ISIS to suicide bomb a hashtag Trump hotel at FBI at Secret Service. It also posted images of Joy Reid with Nazi paraphernalia and the word Goebbels. This was likely an allusion to the baby Goebbels joke I had made on Real Time with Bill Maher about White House speechwriter Stephen Miller. The bot stated, I need all the publicity I can get before I come after Malcolm Nance. I'll be there after at Joy Ann Reid at her gig, hashtag Politicon, hashtag fake news. Cybersecurity experts determined it was a bot not physically located in Denver, Colorado, as its Twitter profile showed, but that it was a VPN used for entry into the U.S. Internet. The bot's true location was then tracked back to St. Petersburg, Russia, likely the Internet Research Agency. Though Twitter was alerted to this account on July 29, 2017, it took weeks for the same false username to be suspended, and only after it had made dozens of additional threatening posts calling for direct confrontation with myself and others. Another American fake news story pushed by Russia was the notorious hoax called hashtag Pizzagate. After the release of emails attributed to former New York Representative Anthony Weiner, a conspiracy theory emerged claiming that a pizza parlor, Comet Ping Pong, in Washington, D.C., was secretly a front for a human trafficking and pedophilia ring. The story claimed that the New York Police Department found evidence of a massive human trafficking racket based on inside sources in the department. The story was then picked up by Sean Adel Tabatabai, who posted it to his fake news site, yournewswire.com, with the additional claim that he had confirmed the claims through an FBI insider. Adel Tabatabai is the former webmaster for conspiracy theorist David Icke. After the post was created, the 4chan message board picked up the story and began to feed on it. 4chan was one of the most popular genesis points for the alt-right subcultures and known for viral campaign generation. Driven by posts by anonymous users, 4chan is the web equivalent of the Wild West, with very lax oversight and a culture of feeding frenzied behavior around fake news and rumor mongering. Conspiracy theorist Alex Jones, InfoWars, and others carried the stories further across the web, each with its own clickbait-driven agenda. The spreading of the story didn't stop in the U.S., but was picked up by sites around the world, often with each adding its own spin, variation, or new material to the claims. In just days, the first claimant of the story had reposted a link to TruePundit.com, who had echoed the original claims as a source of validating it. "My source was right," claimed the Twitter account under the name @DavidGoldbergNY. The story wasn't true, of course, but that didn't stop self-appointed internet sleuths from continuing after the release of emails via WikiLeaks supposedly belonging to John Podesta, Hillary Clinton's campaign advisor. Various people began to pick apart the Podesta emails looking for code words they claimed would substantiate the Pizzagate theory, especially code words related to food. "I'm dreaming about your hot dog stand in Hawaii," wrote Mike Cernovich, alt-right leader and prolific fake news promoter. Under the hashtag PodestaEmails28, Users were combing through the WikiLeaks releases and picking out words like pizza, cheese, pasta, ice cream, and walnut as code for little girls and boys or male prostitutes. Ultimately, the story came to a crescendo when Edgar Madison Welsh of North Carolina traveled to Washington, D.C. and opened fire on the restaurant with an AR-15 on December 4, 2016. Welsh was convinced that real crimes were being committed and decided to take matters into his own hands. He was charged in December 2016, entered a plea agreement on transportation of firearms and assault with a deadly weapon on March 24, 2017, and was sentenced to a fine and 4 years in prison. Additionally, a Shreveport, Louisiana man, Yusuf Lee Jones, called in a threat to shoot up another restaurant just 3 days after the Walsh shooting. Jones called the Besta Pizza restaurant in Washington, D.C., claiming he was going to shoot everyone in the place to save the kids. Jones was arrested and pled guilty to issuing criminal threats against the restaurant on January 12, 2017. Though the story had been debunked in plenty of outlets, the restaurant faced an onslaught of continued harassment. The owners and others are still repeatedly threatened via social media. The story wasn't limited to fake news sites. Donald Trump's campaign team member and soon-to-be National Security Advisor Michael Flynn shared the story via his Twitter channel, as did his son, Michael Flynn Jr., who added, "Until hashtag Pizzagate proven to be false, it'll remain a story." Hashtag Pizzagate may have been the most popularized fake news story of the campaign season, but not the most terrifying in terms of the number of people who were affected. In St. Mary Parish, Louisiana, residents were targeted with the fake news headline, "Toxic Fume Hazard Warning in this area until 1:30 p.m., which prompted calls to the local Homeland Security Office on September 11, 2014. Though there were hundreds of Twitter accounts discussing the powerful explosion under the hashtag Colombian Chemicals, in fact, there was no emergency. Despite the tweets and posts, the event was a hoax. Ultimately, Colombian Chemicals sent out a news release that there was no explosion and the reports were false. Despite it being a hoax, the non-event even had a Wikipedia page and a YouTube video purported to be an ISIS claim of responsibility with women in full burqa waving guns. On March 10, 2015, another similar hashtag, Phosphorus Disaster, was launched. It claimed that a large spill of phosphorus was dumped into American Falls, along with hashtag American Falls, in Idaho. On October 4, 2014, a hashtag hit Twitter thanks to the Internet Research Agency. This time it was hashtag Material Evidence. A Facebook event was inviting people to an art exhibit on West 21st Street in New York City with photos of Syria and Ukraine. When reporters from Gawker sought the funding source of the exhibit, they were told the gallery source was from a silent guy who came back with a bag of cash and dropped it for them with no explanation. The show ran from September to October 2014, and advertisement for the show was ubiquitously posted around the city on buses and subway posters. After emails were hacked by Anonymous International and leaked to the web, it was shown that among the financiers of this campaign was the Internet Research Agency of St. Petersburg. These are just a small sample of the efforts being conducted by the Internet Research Agency not only in the United States, but around the world. A review of the digital infrastructure behind these hashtag campaigns linked the Twitter accounts to a mass posting tool called Mass, M-A-S-S-S, Post, tied to a domain in Russia, ad1.ru. New York Times reporter Adrian Chen asked Mikhail Burchik, alleged leader of the RFIRA troll farm, if he registered the domain, and Burchik denied it. Leaked emails stolen by the hacker activist group Anonymous tied Borchik back to the organization. Julian Hans of the German newspaper Süddeutsche Zeitung claims Borchik affirmed ownership of the leaked emails before denying it to Chen. Frustrated with accusations that InfoWars was a Russian hashtag generator, Alex Jones posted a photo of his Russian business visa and tweeted mockingly, "Looking forward to Putin giving me the new hashtags to use against Hillary and the Dems." Little did he know he was revealing something not far from the truth. Jones had been a highly reliable source of fake news for the Russian propaganda warfare structure, and his conspiracy theories were hashtagged like crazy by the RFIRA. His nutty commentary is widely admired by some of Russia's leading politicians, and thanks to his own tweet, he revealed he had been issued a long-term business visa to keep his special brand of conspiracy mongering alive. What does the fuck say? BuzzFeed's Shira Frenkel discovered that Russia Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu reported to the Duma that Russia was engaged in a propaganda war. Shoigu said that Russia's cyber army are expected to be a far more effective tool than all we used before for counter-propaganda purposes. The ability to use the World Wide Web to execute many different avenues of attack would also explain why Russia chose WikiLeaks. They needed credibility on the world stage. Russian military strategists Colonel Chekhinov and Lieutenant General Bogdanov described the efficiency of using non-attributable agencies such as non-governmental organizations to mask the work of intelligence operations in information war. They said, "It is preferable to have a foreign non-profit, non-governmental organization, NGO, that could best contribute to the attainment of the goal of a hybrid operation. It can be established beyond the Russian Federation under the rules of a foreign country and can draw its members from residents." Sergei P. Rastarguyev, a Russian military hybrid warfare analyst, wrote an apocryphal story to illustrate the objectives of the coming cyber warfare with America and Europe in Philosophy of Information Warfare. "Once there was a fox that wanted to eat a turtle, but whenever he tried to, it withdrew into its shell. He bit it and he shook it, but he wasn't getting anywhere. One day he had an idea. He made the turtle an offer to buy its shell. But the turtle was clever and knew it would be eaten without this protection, so it refused. Time passed, until one day there appeared a television hanging in a tree, displaying images of flocks of happy, naked turtles flying. The turtle was amazed. Oh, they can fly. But wouldn't it be dangerous to give up your shell? Hark, the voice on television was announcing that the fox had become a vegetarian. If I could only take off my shell, my life would be so much easier, thought the turtle. If the turtle would only give up its shell, it would be so much easier to eat, thought the fox, and paid for more broadcasts advertising flying turtles. One morning, when the sky seemed bigger and brighter than usual, the turtle removed its shell. What it fatally failed to be understood is that the aim of information warfare is to induce an adversary to let down its guard. With all systems in place, Russian assets of the FSB, SVR, GRU, the Military Intelligence Directorate, and Russia's NSA, the Special Communications Information Service, were poised to strike a direct attack at the target they've been trying to hit for over 70 years, American democracy. Chapter 9. Hail Hydra. On July 22, 2011, 33-year-old Norwegian right-wing extremist Anders Behring Breivik set out dressed as a policeman to strike a blow against the ruling Norwegian Labour Party. Breivik had spent months building a 2,100-pound bomb that he placed in a large panel van. His plan was to explode it in the middle of the Norwegian governmental district, the Regjeringskvartalet. He intended to destroy the central building where the government bureaucracy was housed. If he was lucky, he would kill the prime minister and everyone inside of the building. In his mind, the liberal Norwegian Labour Party had allowed Muslims into Norway, and that meant the purity of Norwegian blood would be corrupted by immigrant blood if mixed. To him, this government-sanctioned miscegenation was a crime against the white race. He blamed the Labour Party, and he was going to punish them. Breivik forged a police identity card and uniform, drove a car into downtown Oslo, and set off the bomb, killing 8 people. When the car bomb went off, Oslo was in panic. Terrorism had never reached its shores at this level, and the world watched, thinking Islamic suicide bombers had chosen the soft Nordic nation for punishment. That was Breivik's intent. He wanted the world watching in one direction, while he went off to perform a second act of white nationalist terrorism. Breivik drove west out of the city into the wooded countryside. It is stunningly beautiful land filled with lakes, bays, and small islands. Still dressed as a policeman, he drove to Utøya Island. This was a small private island that was known for its gathering at the ruling Labour Party's Workers' Youth League camp. When he arrived there, he loaded an American-made Mini 14 semi-automatic rifle. The rifle was a cut-down version of the U.S. battle rifle from the 1950s, but its powerful 7.62mm NATO bullet could knock down a moose in seconds since it had a magazine capacity of 10 bullets. He also carried a Glock 17 pistol with multiple 15-round magazines. In preparation for his murders, he scored the tips of every bullet so they would break apart, then dipped them in nicotine tar to cause burning in the wound canal. He wanted to inflict maximum pain. But Breivik was not there to hunt big game. He was there to kill off the next generation of liberals in Norway. Breivik rode to the camp on the boat designated to get attendees over to the island. Another passenger was the senior leader of the camp, Monica Bosse. Bosse, known as the mother of Utøya, was a beautiful, tall, striking, brown-haired woman. She was also a brilliant scholar and director of the Norwegian Maritime Museum. She volunteered to run the program for the kids on the island. Breivik told her that he was going to the camp to protect the children. She noticed he was acting strangely and confronted him about what was happening in Oslo. He was evasive and did not seem to know even the basics of police procedure. As she disembarked on the island, she knew something was wrong and sprinted off the boat to warn Trond Berntsen, a city police officer assigned to protect the camp. Breivik realized he was compromised. It was at that moment he definitively decided to murder her, the policeman, and all the others. Breivik confessed to what he did with simplicity. I was holding the pistol and there was a bullet in the chamber, and when I lifted the weapon, Monica Bosse said I should not point the gun at the man in front of me. I then pointed the pistol at his head and shot him in the back of the head. Monica started to run, and I shot her once in the head. Then I shot him twice in the head again. I went over to her then and shot her twice in the head. The island was his. No adults were left to stop him. According to his calm testimony at his murder trial, he thought to himself before beginning the massacre, I thought, this is now or never. There were 100 voices in my head saying, don't do it. Don't do it. From there, Breivik systematically started shooting every child he saw, one by one. Children and teens ran screaming and hid, though they could barely escape him. He slowly and methodically walked to each, aimed the Glock at their heads, and snuffed their lives out. For those who were too far away for an effective pistol shot, he methodically took aim with the high-powered rifle and shot them at their center of mass. In his trial, Breivik said he spared some young ones, but he would tell others he was a police officer, beckon them with a finger, and when they came within range, he would shoot for their heads. He seemed to be surprised that his victims stood totally paralyzed with fear as he raised his gun and shot them. By the time Oslo SWAT teams arrived, he had shot and killed 69 teens and adults. Of course, like all cowards, he feared death and surrendered knowing he would never pay with his life. He laughed to himself that Norway was too liberal for the death penalty. He said he mass-murdered the victims, who were between the ages of 13 and 22 years, because they were the next generation of multicultural liberals, whom he labeled Marxists. During his rampage, he shouted at them, "You are going to die today, Marxists!" Their parents had allowed a Muslim invasion of Norway, and in his estimation, he made them pay for their treason to the white race. Anders Behring Breivik was the first of the foot soldiers of the White Revolution being stoked by the neo-Nazi and fascist diaspora that was congealing in America and Europe. Surprisingly, these former Nazis and fascists were being funded and given ideological backing by Russia, a nation savaged by Nazis in World War II. Breivik left no stone unturned. To ensure he would be remembered by his white supremacist brethren, he had written and left behind a 1,518-page manifesto in his home. As an international terrorism expert, a copy was sent to me on the same day it was found by Norwegian domestic intelligence officers. They wanted to know if this was the work of a madman or part of an international right-wing terror network. My assessment was that it was both. Breivik named himself a member of the European Patriot Resistance Movement. Some of what he assessed was a manifestation of ideas in his head, but it was a window into the mindset and links to a consolidation of anti-immigrant conservatives worldwide. They saw themselves as knights of a Templar crusade cleansing Europe of blacks, Muslims, and liberals, but they were, in fact, stormtroopers more akin to the mythical white supremacist villains called Hydra. Hydra was the underground Nazi successor to the Third Reich, immortalized in the Captain America comic books, the Avengers movies, and the television show Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Only this was not an imaginary drama. It was precisely Hydra playing out across Europe and poisoning America. Their motto, "Cut off one head and another arises," was what Breivik and others dreamed. Even their post-Hitler Nazi salute, "Hail Hydra," a modification of Heil Hitler, would be later used by his American brothers who would appropriate the salute with, "Hail Trump, Hail Victory." Breivik may have gained his ideas from a myriad of American racists, extremists, and xenophobes, but he claimed he best identified the Nazi, Putin's Hitler Youth, as a model for the patriotic youth movement. Breivik wrote glowingly of his ideas on the growth of a conservative youth movement. "We must spend the next 20 years wisely and continue our work on creating a pan-European conservative consolidation, a new conservative political ideology which has the potential to appeal to a minimum of 20 to 35% of Western Europeans, including the bulk of our youth. The creation of cultural conservative student organizations in universities all over Europe must be a priority. In order to do this, we have to agree on a consensus for creating a modern, untainted, cultural conservative, patriotic youth movement which will prevent our youths from joining NS or WN movements. This movement should be somewhat like the equivalent of Russia's Nashi. They were Putin's youth movement of 120,000 members aged between 17 and 25. They claim to be anti-fascist, anti-Nazi in name, but as patriotic conservatives, they find themselves in league with both." Breivik wrote a Q&A section in his manifesto where he asked himself who he most wanted to meet. He replied, "The Pope or Vladimir Putin? Putin seems like a fair and resolute leader worthy of respect. Breivik was a canary in the global coal mine of right-wing conservative insurgency that was growing in the heart of Europe. By 2012, this virus of Russian-backed white ethno-nationalism would burn like an underground coal seam. The former Austrian ultra-right chancellor Jörg Haider once said about European leaders worried about the rise of the right that there is a lot of excitement in the European chicken pen, even though the fox hasn't even got in. That idea is quaint. With Russia's assistance, the fox is not only in the pen, it is being elected by the chickens as the rooster-in-chief. Since 9/11, Europe has been slowly sliding toward more authoritarian governments. Many traditional former Warsaw Pact countries in Eastern Europe have pro-Russian government leaders, including Bulgaria's Rumen Radev, Moldova's Igor Dodon, the pro-Russian leader of the Party of Socialists, and even pro-NATO Estonia's center-party leader Jüri Ratas. But the core of Russia's plan would be to harness the white ethnic extremists like Breivik in Western Europe and push them toward political activism. With the European political right in his pocket, Putin would make their autocratic nationalism the dominant political force in the West. The hallmark of these European conservative demagogues was a single-issue hatred of Muslim immigrants, particularly since the Syrian and Libyan migration crises, which led millions of people to flee to Europe. Add to this the rise of ISIS in Syria that led Muslim nationals born in France, Belgium, and Germany to carry out terrorist attacks in their countries of birth. Divisive conservative politicians use this focused hatred to mobilize people based on their emotions. For example, the unabashed Geert Wilders in the Netherlands ran on a national campaign of the demonization of Muslims for decades. He has yet to win, but Muslim immigrant hatred is now the top European national security issue. However, over the last 17 years since the attacks on America, individual European politicians have turned these grievances into viable political parties that are gaining power. What is at play here is that since 2001, Moscow has observed these nationalist racist trends and found they aligned with their own newfound cultural conservatism. They saw this as a chink in Europe's armor. Putin must have realized that by co-opting extremist European and American conservatives who were naturally aligned with Russia, the Kremlin spent the last decade establishing a durable network of European populists who are fashioning themselves and their political parties in the same mold as Vladimir Putin and his United Russia Party. Putin's new Eurasian political fellow travelers are an amalgam of fascists, neo-Nazis, and nationalist political parties that for the last 7 years were sidelined as they espoused the beliefs of Hitler, Mussolini, and the defeated demagogues of World War II. These shunned parties and personalities have suddenly found new life as nationalist Christian conservatives who want to destroy the status quo in Europe and eventually in the United States. The Europeans also understand that they have been held back by democracy itself, and they admire the plan to use democracy to establish autocracies led by themselves. From there, they can assist Moscow in breaking America's politically correct democratic values of diversity, inclusiveness, globalization, and reliance on NATO and the European Union. The newly rehabilitated European fascists and Nazis also liked Putin's tough guy image and confrontational tribalism, as opposed to Barack Obama's studiousness and dealing with geopolitical power with thoughtfulness. These European xenophobic parties have the universal characteristic of openly aligning themselves with Moscow and accepting their overt and covert political patronage, including being openly funded by Moscow. As a sign of their gratitude, Moscow has become the de facto capital of the anti-Atlantic anti-globalization, white, conservative world. These groups all have the same ideological worldview. They see themselves as the opponents to the NATO-European world order. They want to realign the world with Moscow as the Christian cultural protector who helps them smash the establishments that kept stability since World War II. As Dugin said,